If I'm on a topic that's on something you've got an example of, throw it at me.
Excellent.
I'll duck and be terrified.
And started watching the new Fallout series.
Oh, so I haven't started it yet because my partner wants to watch some of it with me and he's not come over yet since it came out. But how is it? What do you think?
I like it a lot so far. I've watched two thirds of the first, three quarters maybe of the first episode.
Nice.
I think it's very well done so far. I'm a big fan of the Fallout games, and I think they've captured it pretty well so far. We haven't had much of the Wasteland yet, so I'm excited for that.
Yeah, it's I've seen the reviews I've seen so far. Alan Sappermore's review was interesting because he's got like no real knowledge of the games, and he was really open about that in the review. And he kind of said like,
It was that, sir?
Alan Sappermore, who's
Okay.
he's a TV critic for Rolling Stone. He's one
Oh,
of my
nice.
favorite like culture writers, and he was like, "This has the potential to be a really good show, and I'm pretty sure if you do play the games, like you're going to love it." But for me, this is kind of just a mid TV show, which fair. And then I've seen some people who play the games say they really love it. I've seen some people play the games like pissed off about whatever people get pissed off about.
Yeah, I've deliberately avoided discussion of it because if someone points something out and then I focus on it, I'll be annoyed. I'll wait till I finished it and then read all the Twitter arguments.
It was quite funny in that Alan Sappermore review where he brings up the music that gets used, and it's this juxtaposing of this era of music against this like aesthetic. And he sort of had this whole comment about it being a very tired thing that's overdone now. And I was reading that comment like, you're going to have a lot of people probably commenting on this piece and trying to explain to you that Fallout did it, if not first, then but definitely before it was a trope.
Yeah,
And if the show
yeah.
didn't do that, it would be really fucking weird.
Yeah, it's the Gernsbackian future, retro futurism.
Yes.
Very, yeah. Yeah. I feel like before writing that article, you should probably find that
Again, he was really open. Like, I'm guessing this is in here because it's a thing for the games, but watching it as someone who's not played the games, this was my reaction to it. It wasn't, it didn't have like an arrogant, this is bad because I don't know enough about it vibe.
Oh no, I no, I understood that. I just think it's silly not to at least Google something before writing about it, even in passing. Also, I think a lot of these media writers are very much say things like that, like, oh, if I'm picking up on it, then surely everyone will. It's like no one watches as much TV as you guys do. Like
The thing.
it's weird to watch that much telly. I think most people will be fine.
Speaking as someone who watches way too much telly, yes, no, it's weird, and my brain is rot. Speaking of watching TV, the Pretty Little Liars video that we were talking about last week, I've now started planning something around season one of the OC based on that and the ridiculous paragraph from my book I sent you earlier.
I'm very glad that in some small way my insomnia habits have inspired you.
I just think it would be really fun to try and explain, like, just how much fucking plot got burnt through in that first season, because it is kind of ridiculous.
I would like you to do that. That's good. Looking forward to that. Do you you do have a cork board, don't
I actually don't. I need to get like a big cork board. So yeah, this time next week, I'm going to be in New York.
Yeah, you are.
I'm
Buffy
really
prom.
excited. Buffy prom, buffering prom.
So the Friday night's trivia night, Saturday night is prom. Saturday daytime, is that some kind of like con thing, or
No, it's
just you
literally.
have the day to be in New York?
Yeah, I have
Oh,
the
cool.
whole Friday and Saturday to be in New York, plus like the Sunday after the watch thing and all of Monday before I fly home.
Do
So
you
not all of
have
Monday.
New York plans?
I have places I want to go, but I am trying to be aware of like I cannot see the whole city in 2 days. I'm going to do some exploring in Brooklyn. I may try and go to Coney Island.
That is the oh the little funfair place, right? The little funfair place
Yeah,
that
like the
had
whole
the
beach and funfair
yeah.
stuff.
That was where they had the first incubators for babies.
Ah, did not know that.
The babies were on display. Oh, were they the first ones or the first ones of their kind or something like that? But basically, the guy who ran the fair there paid for them in exchange for having the babies as like an attraction.
That's
This
fucked
was
up.
like, I don't know, it kind of is, but on the other hand, those babies would have died.
Well, yeah, that is true. I think you can say it's fucked up, but also it's a good thing those babies didn't die. I think both things can be true.
That's true.
I've been working on the dress throughout the week, but I've also been writing
Got it,
throughout the week. I finished this. I'm really bad at editing, by the way. And
Oh,
I
yeah?
know this to be true already. I finished the first draft of the OC chapter this week, and then and I whenever I finish a draft, I take a day and then I rewrite it right away while it's all fresh in my mind and just make it coherent. Consistently, that second draft always ends up longer than the first. Today, 500 words longer than the first.
Which means now that's not an edit, that's a rewrite. That's different.
True. But now this chapter's over 10,000 words long, Francine.
Well, yeah, now you need to leave it for a week and then go back and cut it. But
oh, no, I'm leaving it. I'll come back to it when I've written the first and second draft for the rest of the book.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think that's bad at editing. I think an edit for style can be very different from an edit for length.
Yes, there will be an aggressive length edit.
That's why, despite my love of cutting bits out of writing, anything I publish on Substack is way too long, because I do the rewrite. Like, done, I wrote something. Off you go. Because no one's going to tell me off.
I've neglected my Substack.
Yeah, me too. I said that. I was like, every time I publish something, three things in a year.
I haven't published anything yet this year. I might do a review of Fallout once I've watched it.
You're going to start it with? I've never played the game, but I've been talked at interminably by my ex-boss and one of my best friends.
I've, like, very briefly played the game. I just never got into it. Mm. Not that I think it's a bad game. It just didn't click the right buttons in my brain at the time.
I think you need... Because you played it on Alex's PlayStation, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't.
I think you need to be left alone for a few hours to get into Fallout. You need to go immersion mode.
Yeah. That's why I have been struggling. I still haven't actually properly finished Baldur's Gate, because to play it, I need to go full immersion for, like, a few hours at once. And I just haven't had that kind of gaming time recently.
Yeah.
So I've been playing a lot of Tomb Raider instead.
Yeah. I just keep telling Jack off for shooting wildlife in the tombs.
It is quite, like,
why
nice.
Are you shooting a gorilla? Why is there a gorilla in the Greek tomb?
There is an alarming amount of tigers, considering
that a dinosaur.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of dinosaurs. In the Pacific Islands in the third game, dinosaurs. I was in Area 51 before that. Fucking aliens.
Hmm.
Alien spaceship, got radiation poisoning there. There was a bit where there was a big dissected alien hanging on the wall looking a bit like Jesus next to a tank full of orcas.
Sounds like one of my dreams.
Really small orcas.
Yeah. Smorkers.
Smorkers. Right, God. Let's make a podcast, Francine. Do you want to make a podcast?
Yeah, let's make a podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Tree Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we're usually reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And we're here, it's part three of Nation.
The thrilling conclusion, the last five chapters. So much happens.
So much happens.
And we'll cover it all. Sorry, I'm gone, announcer.
And we'll cover it all, plus anything else that crosses
our mind. Now, you sounded like a threat.
I can't help it. It's who I am as a person. Spoilers. Note on spoilers before we crack on. We're a spoiler-light podcast, obviously heavy spoilers for the book Nation, but we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series, past unseen academicals, the book we're currently up to, and we're saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
Sailing until we're so far from home, we're back again.
One quick bit of follow-up. Jed from our Discord informed us that he was captain of his local pub's Aunt Sally team for a couple of years. Now, so Aunt Sally came up when you were talking about Coconut Shies last week.
Yes.
I know nothing about this game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, me neither. I got what I did say from a Wikipedia page that I think was painfully apparent.
According to Jed, it's very little known outside of South Oxfordshire.
Oh, South Oxfordshire.
That explains South Oxfordshire. I just want to read out Jed's comment here. It's great fun, if a little scary being the caller, brackets, umpire who sees if the dolly has been knocked off the iron cleanly, when you're at a venue which has a shed to throw into. The bang an Aunt Sally stick makes when someone misses by miles and it hits the shed next to your head is deafening. I am none the wiser about how this game is played based on that. I don't want to know. Please, no listener, feel like you need to explain further. I am delighted by that explanation with a lack of context.
The dolly, the iron, the stick...
The shed.
there's a grand old British traditions, aren't there, of getting a little bit drunk and throwing things at other things, in pubs specifically.
Yeah, we've got skittles and all of that sort of stuff.
Welly throwing, horseshoes.
Horseshoes, yeah.
Of course, these days you can get drunk and, for some god-awful reason on a corporate event, throw axes. There's those axe-throwing places you're not meant to get drunk first, I don't think.
No, I would quite like to go axe throwing, though. It looks like fun to me.
I'd be so bad at it, but I'd like to watch you throw an axe.
I feel like I'd be good at it. I've got no evidence for that whatsoever, but I feel like I could throw an axe.
Yeah, I feel like you could, yeah. All right, we'll do that one day.
Right, let's talk about the book Nation, shall we? Before we dive deeply into the episode, quick content warning, we are going to be discussing both implied threats of sexual violence today, and we will be talking about the racial slurs used in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So proceed accordingly. Francine, do you want to tell us what happened previously on Nation?
Yes. Previously on Nation. Twinkle, twinkle, guiding star. Mal finds out what trousers are. Daphne wears a skirt of grass. They meet, and, well, you've got to laugh. That's as far as that's going, don't worry. Mal dives to retrieve the last god anchor and returns with a faith-shaking announcement. The White Stone has company. Ataba almost dies in his attempts to destroy the demon anchors, but is pulled from the waves by Mao, who shouts at a shark, swims to shore, and then sleeps so deeply he has to be fetched from the Shadowlands by Daphne. Once everybody's finally conscious, the demon boy, the ghost girl, and the increasingly irritable priest explore the Cave of the Grandfathers and find that the nation's history stretches back further than any of them could have imagined. After an Indiana-coded escape from millennia's worth of disintegrating skeletons, they emerge into the light, only to face the danger they didn't see coming.
Ooh.
And then from there, what happened?
This section, which begins in chapter 11 and goes all the way to the end. In chapter 11, Daphne tries to talk Foxlip and Polgrave and their loaded guns off the island. She takes them to her hut at the women's place and offers them a drink, but Foxlip won't sing, and she tells Polgrave to run. Daphne tells Mao she wants a trial and passes out. Mao unceremoniously disposes of Foxlip. The next day, Ataba is sent to the waves with great ceremony. The nation has its first court, and Pilu tells an old story. Daphne explains the mutiny on the Sweet Judy and warns the island about First Mate Cox, and the trial agrees that she's done justice, not a murder. In chapter 12, it's likely that Cox has taken charge of the cannibals and is on his way to Nation. Daphne shows Mao just how important the History Cave could be. She wants the Royal Society to see. First, though, the island needs defending. Mao has a plan, and it requires the Sweet Judy's cannons. The islanders test their defences, but nothing happens, and it keeps happening. The last resort finds a shipwrecked passenger. While on the island, everyone gets much better at shouting bang. In chapter 13, the raiders come, just before dawn. Cox is in charge, and a parley begins. A single cannon capsizes raider canoes. Mao faces Cox and its guns versus spear in single combat. In chapter 14, Cox has sand in his eyes and Mao's in the water. Bullets sink and there's blood in the waves and an axe in a tree. The axe comes out of the water as Cox reloads and the sharks arrive as he starts to sink. Out of the water and with Lokahara at his side, Mao turns down a perfect world. In chapter 15, Mao's awake and the island's at work. A ship comes. Daphne's father's found her. She shows him the cave and they discuss everything. Mao and the Loose Island Council discuss everything. Daphne and her father get their time on the island, but another ship comes and the Cutty Wren delivers a quick coronation. The king stands up to his mother and invites Mao to join the empire. Mao counters with the Royal Society and gives up the Golden Door in exchange for necessities. 7 days later, Daphne says her goodbyes. In the epilogue, an old man tells a boy and a girl the story, and they debate what could and should have been. He shows them Jupiter before the girl takes her watch, guarding the nation as the observatories wake for the night.
Very nice.
I love the observatories.
Yes, the I love that idea. Yeah, the rumbling observatories of the
island. It's beautiful. Beautiful image. Helicopter and loincloth watch. I know I said we were going for the obscure loincloths, but this line was too good to not give it loincloth for the episode. You say you walk in the shadow of Lokaha, but they walked in his loincloth when he has not bathed for many months.
That's very good.
It is good. And for helicopter, grandmother's umbrella.
Of course. Dangerous.
Which is there for poking.
Incongruous in the island environment.
Very much so. Quotes. Do you want to go first?
Yes. And with that, the dawn chorus exploded, with every bird, frog, toad and insect screaming its head off. Golden light rolled in from the east, melting ragged holes in the mist. It was a beautiful picture, apart from the black and red war canoes. Cool. Amazing. Cool scene setting. Very good.
Very cool scene
ragged
setting.
Holes in the mist. Love that. How about you?
I love that.
There you go.
No. Honourable mention goes
I
to...
Look, I don't like having to use the bleep, but I will.
please bleep me saying call me every time I say it. For context, this is when Daphne asked Mao if he'd go back to a world where the wave never happened.
Mm-hmm.
How can I answer you? There is no language. There was a boy called Mao. I see him in my memory, so proud of himself because he was going to be a man. He cried for his family and turned the tears into rage, and if he could, he would say, did not happen, and the wave would roll backwards and have never been. But there is another boy, and he is called Mao too, and his head is on fire with new things. What does he say? He was born in the wave, and he knows that the world is round, and he met a ghost girl who's sorry she shot at him. He called himself the little blue hermit crab, scuttling across the sand in search of a new shell. But now he looks at the sky and knows no shell will ever be big enough, ever. Will you ask him not to be? Any answer will be the wrong one.
Incredible.
Incredible speech, incredible lines. And I love that idea of, well, as well, being asked the question, you know, if you could go back, if you could have this not happen to you. And that really honest answer of, I can't answer that, because yes, part of me would love that to have not happened, but I wouldn't be the person I was without that.
Yes.
And it's the person I am who you're asking that question of.
Mm. Ooh.
Let's talk about Mao.
Okay.
Different characters.
while we're on the subject, yeah. He comes into his own in a not quite an avatar way. A reluctant avatar for a minute.
Yeah, it's a quick go at avataring, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. I think it's very sweet near the beginning of the section when sort of Ataba's funeral, I guess. Maybe sweet's not the right word, but he sort of confronts Lakaha and says, you should send him to the perfect world now.
Mm-hmm.
And says that he deserves it. Even if I think you're all dicks, he believed in you. And he gives the line, he deserved better gods.
Yes. And Lakaha is like, but you don't believe in me. I was like, but he did, and I'm talking to you, so let's not have this metaphysical. And then later, of course, he gets the choice.
He's offered the perfect world, yeah.
Mm.
And he turns it down. He kind of understands this need for it to be a journey and not a place.
Yes. The journey, Joanna.
The journey? I'm just trying really hard not to do it.
We finally found a use of the journey that we can't dislike.
We'll allow the journey in that very specific situation. But yeah, talking of him coming into his own, we see his relationship to being the chief grow more in this. And this the reason he's being considered the chief by everyone. There's a really great line when they're sitting in the circle and having their trial, effectively. Mm. Everyone should make up their own mind. And there's this repeated, and there was Mao sitting in the circle, this refrain.
Mm.
He's described as not big, not even tattooed, not shouting orders, but somehow being slightly more than everyone else.
Mm. Yes. And I'd forgotten, we talked last week briefly about how they hadn't really had a go about his age. And I'd forgotten there was a couple of lines here where it says, like, you know, there were some mumblings about his age, but that's very quickly again.
Every time someone mumbles, Milo or Carlo turns up like an eclipse of the sun.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like, I think I'd forgotten this in previous reads as well. I haven't put Carlo in as a character, but every time, there's just so many bits referencing her being really hench and intimidating, and I love that.
Yes, I love that. The little mini trope of just, and here's my friend.
And the idea of her and Milo as a couple, and the idea that they're both these big hench intimidating people is great.
I do love it. But yeah, Mao coming into his own, I think the more people that turn up, the more he's chief, the bigger the nation gets, kind of.
The more he needs to be in charge of it.
Mm-hmm. And then I think Daphne pulls him quite deftly out of the micromanaging.
Yeah, he says, I must organise people better. And she says, stop it, tell them to organise themselves.
Mm-hmm. You've got to look at the big picture stuff for a minute. You are obviously right about the lengths of thorns, but...
More importantly, when the raiders are there, and obviously they've underestimated him. They've assumed that Milo's the chief because he is this big, intimidating guy. Mm. And then Milo declares Mao as chief, and, you know, this calm, dramatic speech. He's risen from the country of Lakaha. He set the dead men free. The gods hid from him in a cave, but he found them, and they told him the secret of the world, and he has no soul. Yeah. It's like, get you a hype man like Milo, seriously.
Man, yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's kind of, it is like a hype man stuff, but at the same time, Mao has these, like, real, he's going to be a great leader moments, like, when he's seen everything in the cave, and he gets this welling up of pride, and then he sees it in his head, like, the city under the water kind of thing, and you get a real destined to bring the glory back. I don't like the word glory very much, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You definitely get an aura from him.
Yeah, jumping back as well to that description of him being slightly more than everyone else, I felt like there was a lot of similarity between that and like somehow how Carrot is described.
Mm.
He's just like more present, more there.
Mm. Yeah.
Like just a little bit extra solidity.
Yes, definitely. And I think Pratchett describes kind of two flavors of character like that. You've got your Mao and your Carrot. And you've also got like the real fuckers like Cox and Carsa.
Yeah.
Who just, they're almost like they're, if you're trying to do it visually, like they're superimposed onto the world.
Yes. Yeah, it's almost like if existing was a spectrum and most people are in the middle of it, then they're at opposite ends that are so far apart, they've almost come back around to be next to each other. Yeah, great.
We're getting
great.
A bit metaphysical.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Love it.
So actually, speaking of metaphysical, Mao making himself a soul and Daphne being the one to point it out to the cannibals and saying, look, this guy made himself a soul. It covers the whole island, every leaf and pebble.
Mm, yeah.
And think about that as like part of Mao's healing journey, like taking responsibility for the island, not in the way the grandfathers wanted him to, but in his own way, and how that returns his soul to him, at least to him.
Yeah, we talked in the last two episodes about how just having someone, anyone to look out for is what saves him and what saves Daphne as well.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, when that extends to cover the island. And it's very much, yeah, it's Avatar again, but not of Lukaha.
He's becomes almost the avatar of the island itself.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
To believe in the nation is to believe in Mao. To believe in Mao is to believe in the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he gets his tattoos at the end.
Mm-hmm.
A sunrise wave.
Yes.
He's sort of taking the nation in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And a little blue hermit crab.
Yes, perfect. I do like that idea. Did it say what kind of shell the hermit crab have it on? I forgot to go back and look.
Well, I assume it's a blue shell.
A blue shell, of course. But, you know, there are types of shells.
I don't know.
There's probably some shellfish that I'm not aware of because it's in this other universe.
Yeah, I'm not particularly familiar with the pelagic shellfish population. No.
We would be if we were given the chance, if somebody gave us a bestiary.
Well, yes, absolutely.
With dedication.
So, Daphne.
Daphne. Wait, no. Daphne. Slightly more Mao for a second.
Oh, sorry.
The bits where he is thinking in facts, I thought you might find interesting as well.
Oh, yeah. Again, it's another refrain mm-hmm. thing. This is a fact, and this is a fact. And mm-hmm. then these are more facts when he's having the fight with Cox.
Yeah, he's like building his castle out of them. I think at some point he said, all falling carefully into place like little grey blocks.
Yes.
And when he's got this, it's really extending the visual metaphor of like the walls inside your head kind of thing. I just thought it was really cool.
Wall of facts. It was cool. And in that fight as well, where he realizes he is thinking like Cox and that mm-hmm. he needs to think like Cox to beat Fox,
mm.
to beat Cox.
Mm-hmm.
Please take that out of context.
Yep, will.
And it occurs to him to think like him is not to be him. The hunter learns the ways of the hog, but he is not bacon.
Yes.
And I think that's something that isn't stated really obviously. A lot of the time you get like a lot of these sort of stories of, to be the villain, I must think like the villain. And, now I've been corrupted because I thought like the villain. So I like Mal's like, that doesn't make me a bad guy. That makes me good at thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that is always a bit squeaky, isn't it? It's like, to be the villain, I must have thought like the villain. And that implies that to think like the villain, you know, thinking this way is somehow more appealing. Whereas for most people, you'd think that way and you're like, ugh, grubby.
Yeah. Brain shower.
Yuck. Gonna hit that with an axe.
Right, Daphne.
Yes.
When Foxlip and Polgrave make her swear on her mother and it creates a very specific brand of rage in her.
Mm. But she gets to think for a second. Well, it's an important swear and I'm going to think about it. That's a bit Tiffany, I thought.
It is a bit Tiffany. I mean, she's thinking, you know, does he know? Of course he doesn't know. He doesn't know. Calm thoughts floating in a sea of fury.
Mm.
And then she thinks to herself, and that was a sin. Asking her to make the oath is a sin. And she's thinking about that while she's thinking about what she's going to do with the beer. And she says, thinks to herself, what I'm going to do won't be murder. Murder is a sin. It won't be murder.
Little aside, interesting that Daphne's second or third thoughts are in square brackets. We don't often see that one in the...
Yeah.
Pratchett has infinite ways of showing... internal arguments, and I quite like that they're different for each character. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Everybody's internal conflicts are slightly differently formatted, metaphorically, and in this case, literally.
Yes. Her whole like internal struggle with doing this thing, killing Foxlip, sort of, and whether it's she's done a bad thing or not, and how premeditated, and is it murder? Because she just gave him the opportunity to live, but she also knows there's no way he's going to sing the song.
Yes.
So yeah, the square brackets, the third thoughts argument, and it's really well written because she's kind of drunk while she's having the argument.
Oh yeah,
she's had some of the beer and she's
yeah,
never
she
had
did throw it up, but not quick enough. Yeah.
She's racked with sobs while also having a very rational conversation with herself.
Yes. The whole thing about, was it murder, even though I made him do it to himself kind of thing, because I knew he would, is a little bit vimes with the werewolf, isn't it?
That was exactly what I was about
to say. Oh, sorry.
No, we're just very on the same wavelength. The way she thinks to herself about it, there should be a judge and a jury. If they were found guilty, they'd be hanged by the hangman neatly and properly. And he'd have his breakfast first very calmly and perhaps say a prayer. And he would hang them calmly and without anger, because at that moment he would be the law. Mm. And it's the he would be the law that made me think of the werewolf. But it's all an idea that Pratchett's really good at interrogating. And he takes the route of it's definitely dealing with the choice to kill someone rather than doing it and then going, oh my God, I killed someone.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it didn't really explore the, again, I guess because they're dealing with the facts. This is what happened. This is what happened. But didn't really explore the, I've got to kill him because otherwise he's going to go kill someone else here.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's underlying is the reason she makes that choice is to save other people's lives, which is why it's not, oh my God, I killed someone. It is about her dealing with the choice.
Yeah.
It's not a reaction in the heat of the moment. It is a premeditated, I am doing this. And even if I'm doing it for a good reason, does that mean I should be doing this?
Yes. Yeah. Well, almost a trolley problem.
Almost. And then we get, again, a defamiliarization thing. We get this idea of crime from the point of view who have a widely different concept of a justice system and crime in general.
Yeah. I thought this was very your kind of thing, the description of how the justice system rolled around the different conversations.
And it rolled from tongue to tongue. That was nearly my quote. I thought that was such a great line.
Yeah, it is. And just see it, you can see it so well, can't you? And Pilu going from like conversation to conversation and just sitting down to listen. And yeah.
Yeah. She gets a lovely moment of politeness, just quickly bringing back the I love etiquette for etiquette's sake.
Oh, yeah.
When one of the cannibals says to her, I'd like to eat your brains one day. And she sort of stops and says, it's very kind of you to say so.
Yes, yes. And it was.
It was very kind of him to say so. It was meant as a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
Something else I wanted to talk about with Daphne, as I said in the content warning, there are these threats, or not threats, there's these implied hints of there could be a risk of sexual violence towards her. And I think Pratchett handles it really well here.
Yes.
We've both had rants before. I don't know if we've had them on the podcast or over coffee, of how much we hate like sexual violence being used as a plot point and used to further a plot.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people share that opinion. It's not a rare opinion. But yeah, Pratchett handles it well here by acknowledging that it would at times be potentially a threat for Daphne, while putting it in these impossible situations. The reader never feels at risk of seeing it, and it's done very subtly.
Yes.
So we have things like when the mutiny took place, she'd sat out in her cabin, seated on a small barrel of gunpowder with a loaded pistol, and the captain told her if Cox's men won, she should fire the pistol into the barrel to save her honour.
Yes. And it's always worded in such a way that if you are old enough to get it, you will get it, and if you are not, you won't.
Yeah. And I don't think it's just written like that to protect the young eyes of people who are reading it. It's also written like that because Pratchett doesn't need to be any more explicit than that. There's no glee in it. There's no, oh, look at this horrible thing, even as a potential. It's just a realistic, this is it, and this is how the captain thinks it should be dealt with, and this is how Daphne, who doesn't quite know what's implied by that, considers how much worth is a saved honour if it's falling out of the sky in pieces.
Well, Pratchett, this is a good point. I mean, Pratchett never really does the relishing in the tension up to something horrible happening, does he? I think the two side effects of his kind of sudden bad things happening to people are that, one, you do get this this feeling that, oh, fuck, something can just happen, which is important in a lot of these contexts. And two, you don't have this horrible sick
tension
building
happen.
Up to it, which I know some people enjoy. I hate. And that's maybe one of the reasons, like one of the many reasons, obviously, I like these books so much is that I don't get that horrible feeling.
yeah, you don't want to spend ages dreading this horrible thing. Mm-hmm. You know what happened. It's almost a cousin to like how much you struggle with like secondhand embarrassment if you're watching something.
Oh yeah, God, I can't. Yeah. Oh God, I've started rewatching The Office. Painful. Why do I do it?
And there's also like this moment of awkwardness when her father turns up and he sort of stutters out, "Did anyone try to be beastly?
Yeah.
To you?" That's about as much as he can say with it.
Yes, and Daphne manages to portray that she doesn't know what he's talking about. She does. Yep. But reassure him at the same time.
Yes, she's absolutely fine. And the only people who've been beastly are Foxlip and Bulgrave. Yes. And Cox.
And they're dead or gone.
And they're wonderfully dead.
I poisoned one. Mao hit the other in the chest with an axe and something fell out of the tree into the third one and he didn't enjoy it at all.
No. And then Cox killed him.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk about Mao and Daphne together before we move on to the other characters because I love them.
Yep. Quickly connected to what we were just talking about with the Pratchett not feeling the need to like go into what could happen, this, that, or the other. I like the way he handled, like, maybe a couple kisses happened. Who can say? Yeah. When Pratchett writes romance, which he rarely does, but I do. I like the way he doesn't try and shoehorn another genre or style of writing or anything in, and you know, he doesn't do the whole teenage romance, oh, first kiss, this, that, or the other. Like it wouldn't feel
right reading that in a Pratchett book.
No.
I love, yeah, this is probably my favourite romantic storyline that Pratchett's written, because we rarely get, as you say, we rarely get him writing romance. He's written a lot of couples that I love, but we don't rarely get much of the couple getting together. The only other example I can really think of is Carrot and Angua.
What about literally the last book?
Well, and we have the sort of crush and stuff with Tiffany and Roland and Winter
Smith. And Cena Academicals. Yeah.
Oh wait, yeah. All right.
We talked about the romance aspect.
Yeah, but they're a B plot. Mm-hmm. But yes, no, you are right.
Yeah, yeah. But so are you. It doesn't come up much. It's really only come up a bit recently.
And it's very sweet between Daphne and Mao. It's the rom com stuff that I mentioned. You know, Rob Wilkins sort of thought of their relationship as this very rom com relationship. So I think I had that in my mind when I was reading this time and noticing a bit more of it.
Yeah, I also like the fact that it. I know Rob's thing was he wanted it to end. He wanted Pratchett to write him like a special ending, like just for him, maybe just so he can see them get together. And Pratchett's like, nope,
can't have that.
This is how it happened. I quite like that. I think that more stories should be slightly unsatisfying that way. That sounds very odd, but
no, I completely agree with you.
I like romantic platonic.
Yep.
The relationship that could have been but wasn't, but is still meaningful and impactful through the rest of your life, or stops there, but was still something that happened and made you. I like that.
Obviously, speaking of someone who's like consuming lots of these teen dramas for the book I'm writing, and like it's a very, very, very common thing that you'll have these two teenagers who meet in high school, and the happy ending to the show will be those two together and getting married.
Oh, fucking Parks and Rec. Sorry, I know that's not even a teen drama, but I will never forgive the Parks and Rec writers for doing this to Andy and April.
Oh, I didn't mind that so much because they threw in the wedding after they'd been dating like a week and it was really early and random, and then it kind of worked.
The epilogue, they made her have like kids and they had
they just were, they were really like,
oh, here's the bog standard happy ending for you guys as well.
Yeah, no, that bit was cringe. I didn't like that. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, sorry. So back to Mao and Taff.
Sorry.
the thing you mentioned, the first time I saved her life, I saved mine too. And which the one person is nothing, two people are a nation, which ties into, you know, Mao's need to the leadership thing. He needs to save the nation by leading it because he needs that to live. We have the sort of lovely, and it's brushed over quite quickly, Mao realizing that Daphne was trying to shoot him the first time they met.
Yeah, I thought in my head that was a bigger deal than it was, because there was the little moment where Daphne realizes that Mao's realized. When I read that, I was like, oh, is there that whole bit where he gets like really angry about this? And no, he's very mature about it.
He calmly says, I don't want to be shot a second time. Remember. but thinking about it in like a rom-com context, there's always that misunderstanding and now we're annoyed at each other. And I felt like there's all the hints of that there.
Yeah, there are hints of that there, but it's not done, because I hate that. The miscommunication one is another one. Fucking hate that, and Pratchett never does it. fucking fantastic.
Yeah, Pratchett doesn't do miscommunication tropes, apart from maybe like occasionally for humour.
Yeah, literally just for humour, though, not drawn out over a 20-minute unrealistic episode, because that would be weird, because he's a writer of books. Yeah.
That would be weird. When they're talking about the cannibals, and Daphne saying, oh, they won't want to eat me, and then Mal says, no, they'd feed you to their wives so that they become beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And then silence, and Daphne says, ahem. And all the other words escaped forever. Much later, and many times, she wondered about what might have been if she hadn't chosen a word that clearly belonged to her grandmother. And that was that. For some people, there is only one right moment for the right word. Mm-hmm. And talking about, you know, wanting to, the idea of wanting to see them together at the end, and this idea of this one moment, the right word. We have this idea of these parallel worlds happens.
Yeah.
There is a world where they were together. There is a world where Daphne said, not a hem.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then she kind of almost repeats the mistake, but it's not a mistake anymore because the moment's gone already at the end when she says goodbye.
Yes.
And she can't say goodbye in a narratively satisfying way. It's very, very witchy, very practical.
Very witchy.
These things need saying, sorry. Yeah. And also, I cannot face saying anything else.
Yeah.
Oh, it was really sweet when Mal was talking about how he knows when she's upset. He goes, I'm sorry, I've upset you. I know when you're upset, your face goes shiny and then you try and act like nothing has happened. Felt that. Personal attack.
Very personal attack. I don't need anyone noticing how shiny my face goes when I'm having an emotion. And Pilu calls her ghost girl who knows the secrets of the sky and makes wonderful beer. Daphne blushed and tried to catch Mal's eye, but he looked away.
Mm-hmm.
There's this idea of them being worshipped together, the Judy being worshipped, and so they're nailing up fish there, and then they're figuring in these stick drawings as if they're being deified, which makes more sense for Mal than it does for Daphne, but I can understand, because she's so other, why she's then being kind of lifted up.
Yes.
You're so alien, you might as well be a god.
And those were the two that were there when everyone else turned up as well, of course.
Yeah, it was just those two on the island, and the parrot.
And the parrot. Oh, thank God for the parrot.
Thank God the parrot's okay.
Going to be very sad if the parrot was not okay. You know how I feel about these things.
I do. I was glad for your sake that the parrot was okay.
How far we've come since the annoying parrot of Eric.
What a good parrot this was.
This is truly the final form of the haunted sword. Sorry, magic sword.
Kring. Fucking Kring. When the parrot turns up at the end a bit forlorn, though, and Daphne explains she's been trying to do something about its language. Show us your dander things. Poor sad parrot.
Fox is a fraud of Satan.
Sorry, a couple of other Daphne and Mal bits. More perving. People have paid good money just to see the muscles on his back move like they were doing now. She understood the maids back home a lot more when the sun gleamed on his shoulders. Ahem.
Teenagers.
I get it. I do get it.
Oh, it is cute.
But there's cute moments, and there's also like these bigger emotional moments. Talking about the facts after the raiders leave, when she held him as they watched the tragic cargoes unloaded and did not move until the last war canoe was a dot on the never-ending horizon, that was a fact as big as the nation.
The one real rom-com moment that I highlighted was they're holding each other. Mm-hmm. And the moment where he turns her around, so she's looking at the sea to see the ship.
Oh, yeah.
How cinematic is that? Gently turned around so that she was looking at the sea. The ship coming, he said.
And he sort of established what will happen when the ship comes with her before he shows her that the ship is there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
And yeah, as we were talking about at the end, No more words. We know them all the words that should not be said, but you have made my world more perfect. The Banner John misses We Are as lecture come off tomorrow. All right, well, let's not cry. Let's talk about dickheads who deserve to die. Let's talk about Foxlip and Palgrave.
Okay. So, dickheads deserve to die.
Absolutely, dickheads who deserve to die. Right, well, that's done. No, there's something great about right at the beginning of this section, immediately after Ataba's been shot, then Foxlip committed suicide. He didn't know it at the time, but that's how it started, and it sets up almost like reassuringly that he's not long for this world.
Yes.
And that that is absolutely justified with the next sentence. He pulled out his other pistol and growled, "Tell him not to move. First one who does, he's a dead darkie. You tell him that right now."
Yeah. Yeah. And at that point, Daphne's like, well, I'll die.
Yeah.
You're going to keep doing that.
I want to talk a little bit about the choice to use darkie in this context, because it's very much, it is a racial slur. Like, it is not something you would say.
No.
But it's not arguably unprintable, especially it's being used in this concept context. Using is not approval of that language is to show what a dickhead this guy is.
Yes.
But I think it was a it was an interesting choice to use that, and I think it was a clever choice to use that particular slur, because it is a gross thing to say, but especially from a British context, I do think it's a British slur. It's not something you would never hear. It's a pub slur. It's said by sad old racist men occasionally. So yeah, I think it was an interesting writing choice, and I think it was a good writing choice, because I again, the fact that he's using this immediate slur, and also like Mao and the others pick up, like, he thinks of us as that. He's using that word, and he's using that word, he means savages, he means animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can hear the tone of voice in something, even if you don't know what the word is. That's a slur.
Yeah, that's when Mao gives his perspective on them at the trial. These were men who'd shoot a brown man for no reason and would shoot dolphins, which either trousermen men respect, and we're savages to them. We're this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think proving that they are definitely not the savage ones here, I mean, Mao gives him the same burial as he gave everybody else.
But without the ceremony of it, it's a fuck it, you can go down there and get eaten by sharks. He's not expecting him to become a dolphin, but he is giving him the burial. He's not
He's not leaving him for the red crabs. I think he's just this is what we do. I'm not going to think about it. Like, people are buried here. You know, first step towards sin is thinking of people like things.
Yes.
So even if this one is technically enough of an animal to be, you know, shot when it goes rabid.
Yes. The thing about Palgrave's manners that Daphne starts considering, he says, "Much obliged." It almost broke her heart. Once upon a time, some woman had taught the man his manners, but to thank her, he'd grown up to be a weasel. And now, when he was worried and ill at ease, natural bit of politeness drifted up from the depths like a pure, clear bubble from a swamp.
That almost is like the opposite of Palgrave's. But then he said, and then he committed suicide. And then he committed suicide. Palgrave's saved his life for a little bit there. Stephanie's like, all right, you are a little too human.
And it's his manners that save him, because he considers joining in with the singing. He doesn't drink the beer right away. Because he's sort of politely going along with what she's doing, whereas Foxlip obviously doesn't, and that's what kills him.
Yeah.
Obviously, then Palgrave gets his casual off-screen death instead. I shot him yesterday because he was a pain in the arse, says Cox.
Yeah. There was actually a Palgrave, I think it was Palgrave, but there couldn't be a single thing in this jungle that hadn't tried to bite, peck, or sting him during the last dark, soupy hour. Was that him?
Yeah.
A dark, soupy hour, anyway. I think another of our food chronology metaphors for the folder.
Yes, dark, soupy hour summed up everything I hate about being anywhere even slightly too warm.
Yeah. Oh, no.
So, Cox.
Yes.
This is one of our good Pratchett villains. This is, I think, the caster of flavour of villain, as you said earlier.
Every day and decided to be Mr. Cop.
Where his shadow fell, old friendships snapped and little wars broke out. Milk soured, weevils fled from every stale ship's biscuit, and rats queued up to jump in the sea.
Also, they're cooking.
Yes, they're cooking. The way he tried to shoot Captain Roberts in the face wasn't just enough for him to be a dickhead and be mutinous. He had to go for this one very specific shot on this guy.
He realized that shooting him isn't as cruel as he can be.
Yes,
exactly. The idea of studying him like a rare beetle, I thought was
and the way he goes about it, you know, the asking puzzle questions and this insidious way of putting all the extra hallelujahs and amens and clapping loudly,
it's so off-putting,
giving him too much of what he wants.
It's like the very extreme version of when like the dickhead popular girl at school would like for a laugh one class pretend to be your best mate.
Yes.
And you're like, this is gonna end poorly for me.
Yeah.
I can't just like tell you to fuck off.
Yeah. It's very that, but in a completely different flavour of way, and also on a ship.
Yeah, yeah. I never did find a middle school bully who tried to then, you know, shoot me with a cannon, which is nice.
Yeah, I also was rarely shot by cannon in middle school.
Not never. But you went to Catholic school.
Yeah, no, a lot more cannons at Catholic school. A lot of cannon. Hey! Oh, God, sorry.
Fuck yes.
Yeah, Mal's question about Cox. How can he rise up every morning and decide to be him?
You worry about some people doing that.
You do worry about some people doing that. But yeah, give it to the Raiders. You know, he shoots at the parrot and looks and bows and looks around very proudly. He shoots at the parrot the way he shot at the brown man and the butterfly and the dolphins. He shot at things for something to shot at. The Raiders, when he's showing off afterwards and bowing, the Raiders glanced at him as if he were a little boy who was proud of having wet himself.
I love that so much. Just, yeah. Just, yeah, fucking, ugh. His smile as well, I thought was very Carsa. It wasn't the nasty little itchy little grin of Palgrave that made you want to wash your hands. It was the grin of a man who is happy in his work.
Yeah.
Just the, because Vimes looking into Carsa's face, just like, and there was no, you know, artifice in it. That was a genuinely happy grin. Like,
I'm having a lovely day and we're having fun, aren't we?
Like, life, Mr. Vimes.
Like crocodiles and sharks. So yeah, really never smile at that crocodile.
Oh yeah, fucking Mao outsmarting him.
Yes,
it's just beautiful. That whole scene, I'll tell you what, we were talking about sick tension never building up, and it doesn't, because again, you know, even though this isn't like a classic, oh, the third pulls the axe out, although, you know,
it is
Chekhov. You know, obviously, that Mao is not going to be killed by Cox.
Yeah, that is not the sort of story that Pratchett is telling her.
No, and so you get to feel a bit of tension without the sickness.
Yes, and the sand in the eyes, when they're standing there, waiting for the fight to start, who's going to pick up their weapon, and then the sand in the eyes, and Mao's been holding his weapon the whole time.
I think if Mao gets to be like a little god of an island, he's definitely a little bit of a trickster god.
Oh yeah, hints of tricks to God. You've got to have fun.
Touched by Lekaha, of course.
Lekaha. Yeah.
I wish I'd looked up and seen how Pratchett pronounced Lekaha. Just so.
Yeah. I'm just going to do it differently every time. It's great fun. The Raiders. And I like this reveal of them as they've made Cox this figurehead leader, hence they're kind of judging him and side-eyeing him behind his back. This comparison to them as the gentry that Daphne's familiar with. They had the well-fed, important, careful look of people who take care not to be at the top.
Wizards. Wizard-coded, I thought, that bit.
Yeah, and there's also a bit of a comparison to the gentleman of the last resort. It's the power behind the crown, which is much more important than whoever's bum might be on the throne at the moment.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Now I think about it, there is that direct line, isn't there? Because if the leader starts getting too mental, you quietly do something about it.
Yes. So it's very that. So yeah, I think you get the really nice comparison there, combined with the more obvious, like, doesn't he look like the Archbishop of Canterbury?
Yeah. Yeah, the one moment you get to like Cox for a half second. Uncanny, isn't it?
And yeah, then Pilu. I just want to talk about Pilu because he gets a couple of really good dramatic speech moments again. When he retells Daphne's story for the court and he acts it out and she can see the different characters he's being. And these characters shouted at one another all the time while Pilu's fingers popped like pistols.
Yeah. Yeah. It must be very satisfying to be able to tell your story in the kind of, you know, stuttering way I do and have it repeated back in Pilu.
Yes.
Like,
I'm going to start doing that. Whenever you start telling me a story, I'm going to start dramatically reenacting it for you as you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm sure that won't be even slightly irritating. That won't make you hate me at all. No, I won't do that. I wouldn't do that to you. And then they have this council of war. They're finally discussing the threat of the raiders. And Pilu talks so fast and hard, the words form pictures in front of her eyes. And what she saw was the Agincourt speech from Henry V.
Yes.
Which is not the Once More Unto the Breach, Dear Friends one. I always mix them up.
Oh.
Once More Unto the Breach, Dear Friends is from Henry V. But the Agincourt speech, the St. Crispin's Day speech, is the we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. Gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here and hold their manhoods cheap while any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day.
Did you know that off the top of your head?
No, I have it in front of me.
Oh, okay. I couldn't see what you were looking at because I was looking at it on my screen.
Yeah, I have odd Shakespeare speeches memorized, but this is not one of them.
Yeah, and of course it's Pilu's descendant.
Yes, in the end, in the epilogue.
Which is nice. The storyteller.
Yeah, and it's almost become a continued role.
Mm,
the
like
storyteller
that.
And his... I forgot to put them in characters, but the storyteller and his elderly pet tree-climbing octopus.
Which is beautiful.
Which is beautiful. All I want is an elderly pet tree-climbing octopus. And just to quickly jump back on last week's theme and talking about this idea of belief and truth, talking about how Pilu speechifies and convinces people, he began with the truth and then he hammered it out until it was very thin but gleamed like Mrs. Gurgle's new teeth at noon.
Yes, which is nice. And then you do see him like hammering stuff out later, like literal metal, which is a nice mirror. Could be a mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he is great. I think he's exactly what you need in this book to be the... Not even just the translator, but the amplifier, the megaphone.
I like
him a lot. What a fun little golden speaker.
What a wonderful golden speaker. And then we have the paper vine woman.
Yes, not the unknown woman.
Yes, the paper vine woman, Fiha-el. Fiha-el. And we kind of figure out why she's traumatized beyond the obvious. And what she's been doing with all of this paper vine, and she's been repairing the cannon, and she begged to be allowed to fire it. And she gathered all the paper vine, woven it into ropes from dawn to dusk, tangling into it the inexhaustible hatred in her heart. And I think it's a really beautiful comparison. After she fires the cannon, she goes back to the cradle. She took up her baby from his cradle made of paper vine. So the same thing she's used to create a weapon is holding her baby. And she kissed him and wept. And of course, she gets a happy ending.
She does. And I love that. Well, you get the two moments with Mal looking at her and seeing the vitriol and being scared by her almost for the first time. Like realizing just how much like hatred was in her heart. And then when he wakes up and she's feeding him, which, by the way, I love the line, when she saw his eyes open, she gave a little shriek, kissed him on the forehead and ran out of the hut. Exactly how I want to be woken up. but like, literally didn't recognise her because the grief coming off of her made such a difference.
Yeah. I think it was interesting with Mal, kind of his terror at her reaction, because he didn't really have any hatred for the raiders. They were something to be dealt with, and they were something to be feared. They were a concern, but he wasn't afraid of them. He just wanted to make sure that they were dealt with properly.
Yeah.
Well, they
hadn't affected him.
Yeah.
Like, directly. Yeah.
So, yeah, it hadn't occurred to him to hate them the way she hated them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was something for him to reckon with. And, of course, she gets a happy ending. Her husband was one of the raiders' captives. She, admittedly, you know, missing a leg, but...
Yeah, yeah.
Luckily. Roundabouts.
Luckily, anaesthesia is a thing, if as long as Mrs. Gurgle's around.
Yes. Handy woman to have. And then who else have we got? Oh, Daphne's father, now King Henry IX.
Thoroughly daughtered. My favourite description of being hectored by one's offspring.
Yep. Being daughtered. A beautiful callback as well, and she's so excited to show him the island and the cave and tell him about it. And then she says to him, she sort of pauses and says, this is the place we might grant God absolution.
Hmm. Yes, as a way to kind of cut through the, you know, colonialism shield of in his head, I think, cut into being a person. Hey, put the flag down.
Yeah, but yeah, definitely immediately.
Remember your grief. All right, now you're in the room. Come on.
Yeah, the way Daphne immediately starts telling the soldiers off if it looks like they're going to try and colonise here.
Yes.
Do not put that fucking flag down. Put that thing back where it came from, also help me. Sorry.
Also, like, when she, yeah, during that bit, which is like, no one should call anyone delightful without written proof.
And then as soon as he's crowned, the first thing he does is tell off his mother.
Yes. She's like, not like this, Daphne. Hang on, hang on, wait for the crown.
Yep, get the crown on. The very notion of nobility that you cling to like grim death means that you will not answer me back.
It is quite funny that he did not feel himself capable of doing this until he had the crown. Because after all, he was always capable of doing this physically. Yeah. There's nothing stopping him, stopping his mum being a prick.
But now he's got the weight of you can't argue with me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I am
very conflict avoidant man.
Well, it's also, I don't think she would brook argument before. She would simply just refuse to accept that argument has happened, but she can't refuse it from the king.
This is true, yeah.
And after he does get his dramatic speech of telling him off, he turns to the gentleman of last resort. That was all right, wasn't it?
Yes.
So, yeah, I thought that was all absolutely wonderful. Oh, and last character, Cookie.
Yes. Ooh.
What a fucking delight of a character.
Yeah, just a really, like, properly introduced in the last third side character.
I mean, he's been sort of mentioned much as, like, Daphne thinks obliquely about what happened on the ship, she sometimes mentions. And there was this person, Cookie, I talked to. Mm-hmm. But properly introduced here, yeah.
Yeah. And they, you get kind of the opposite of the sick tension, I think, because he gets properly introduced in this section.
And immediately rescued.
Yeah, because as soon as he's introduced in, like, the last third of the book and his little boat is detailed, you're like, oh, good, we're going to get him. And then, like, immediately they're like, is that a coffin?
Yeah, his survival coffin.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is an absolutely genius idea, a tiny floating world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I also, I'm completely charmed by the idea of his kitchen as a safe space on the ship, especially for Daphne, which means she has somewhere other than her room that she can be and she can have a talk to someone.
Yeah, you know, never piss off a chef.
Oh yeah, you do not piss off a chef, especially not on a ship.
Yeah.
And he also serves as the narrator for Daphne during the shipboard life. He's the one who makes things clear to her.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Cook/exposition, no. Expositor. Ooh.
With a handy dandy coffin. And yeah, we get the immediate payoff when he's rescued. And I really like the line. The captain tells the gentleman of last resort they should change course because he's seen someone.
Mm.
And they say, well, of course, you already have. And he says, yes, the sea has its own laws.
Yes.
That it was a point of honour for the captain. He would not leave a shipwrecked person.
Absolutely not. This is very much reflected in real life. When Priti Patel or the one after her was telling like the Navy to stop fishing asylum seekers out of the sea, and the Navy's like,
we're not gonna
do that. Yeah. And the Home Secretary just very quickly shut up about that. It was like, you can't make sailors not rescue someone at sea.
Yeah.
Don't be fucking ridiculous. and the whole bit about the dolphins as well. That's very much a, you know, through history superstition, isn't it? You know, crops up again and again. You don't fuck with dolphins.
Yeah, don't fuck about with dolphins.
They're one of those species that are so clearly intelligent.
Yes.
That you really have to be very, very odd to
fuck with dolphins. Yeah. And one last note that Cookie figures out he can strain plankton through his beard because he's seen whales do it.
Yep.
Excellent.
Good work,
choice.
Cookie.
Well done, Cookie.
If I could take a practical item to a desert island, it would be Cookie.
And his coffin.
Yes.
Beautiful.
So we don't have locations, do we?
Yeah, I didn't. Well, we've been to everywhere we're going. Little bits we liked. What did you like?
It's quite a big bit, I suppose. It's the concept and the realisation that Mal's coming to is very big anyway. But I like the visualisation very much, this idea of the stone globe. With lines of gleaming gold emanating from the nation.
Yes.
And throughout to where they explored. I just think that's lovely. Letting his fingers follow a line of gleaming gold across the stone. There were a lot of these lines and they all led to the same place, or rather away from it, as though some giant had thrown spears across the world. Which is very cool.
Yes.
Related, I quite like the realisation that the nation used to be much bigger and had been volcanoed.
And flooded.
And flooded, and yeah.
Yes.
Yep, which is, you know, the geological history of quite a lot of that part of the world in our timeline. But yeah, I like that. What do you like, Joanna?
On the globe thing as well, just one detail, because they talk about it being upside down, the world turned upside down.
Oh, yeah.
And the maps in the book are one's one way up and one's the other way up. I thought that was a really lovely detail.
Yeah. Yeah. It is just discombobulating enough to really drive the point home, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know if I've actually ever clocked it before. If I sort of went, oh, I looked at the map at the beginning. I don't need to look at the map.
Yeah,
at the
end. Maybe.
Knowing what sort of person I am.
Mm.
Cricket is not actually something I like, but I like how it was discussed here. Mm. Especially as like a mini colonialism moment as well. Obviously, that the father turns up and they're having a nice time, but he does try and teach them this English pastime of cricket. He must pass on this English thing.
Yes.
And Carly, who I already talked about, I like her. The idea of her as intimidatingly hench. The second game, she was banned from bowling after she keeps injuring people. And Daphne's father explained that women shouldn't really be allowed to play cricket because they fundamentally didn't understand it. It seemed to Daphne she understood it very well and therefore tried to get it over with as quickly as possible so they could get on with something more interesting.
I really don't see the problem here.
Nope, I absolutely support that. And continued reminder to never explain cricket to me. Also, much like Aunt Sally, I think it's more fun to just speculate.
Yeah.
And in the case of cricket, not understand it. And if you and I find ourselves forced to watch it together, narrating ourselves instead.
Yeah, and if the worst comes to worst, throwing a cricket ball violently.
Yeah, that bit I feel like I can do.
Yes, again, going to pass the throwing onto you.
What else did you like? You like death, don't you?
Oh, I love death. You know me.
Big fan of death.
Yeah. Famously not obsessed with immortality. Francine, that's what they call me. look at her walking next to Mal. The imagery of walking or having death walk beside you or behind you or in front of you pops up a lot in literature and in poetry and things. And I always think it's lovely. I like when he says, I will walk in your steps for a while. Because yes. That's very, you know, there's a sign of respect, obviously, but it's also like, ooh, like,
that must sure be a bit I of want a. That.
Yeah. And obviously, it's like necessary for him at the time, but it is always, it's a bit disturbing for the reader and for, I'm sure, everybody watching him to see, you know, the greyness filling the air around him as he walked and the great wings of Lokar beating gently felt like metal, hard and sharp and cold. And I love this idea of just the raiders being able to see exactly what's going on and everybody else just seeing him like as this hardened for a minute chieftain.
Yeah, I think there's something as well about the fact that it's I shall walk with you. I shall walk in your footsteps for a while. It's not you're not given a mental image of possession apart from possibly with how the raiders are looking at him and they're seeing him and sort of the shadow of Lokahar over him. But it's not like he's stepped into Mal's body and given him powers in that moment. It is a next to, I'm adjacent.
Yes. Whereas at the start, when he walks in Lokahar's footsteps, he is very much like just allowing himself to be dragged along.
Yes.
Because that's what necessary at the time. Yeah. It is interesting. Lokahar as a character, still very interesting, just as like a, he is morally neither good nor bad. Much ambiguous. As death is in Discworld, but morally ambiguous, thank you. Not even ambiguous, because I don't think there's any ambiguity. He's not good and he's not bad, he just is.
Yeah.
In the same way that death is, but he's a very different character to death because he's got this, it's not even glee about it, he's got this trickster mischief kind of, I think he takes a little more glee in what happens than death does, even if him as a force is not good or bad.
Yeah, and I think there's something as well about how, you know, he's potentially there's a lot of boredom for Lokahar, as much as someone could feel such a thing as boredom, and he's fascinated and interested in Mal because Mal pushes back.
Yes.
And there's not a lot of pushback because a lot of people have had this just blind faith.
Yeah, and there's no deals to be made with him and there's no, like, negotiation, but I think he takes satisfaction in the fact that he's always picked the right people to make this choice because they always make the same choice, which is to continue their journey.
Yes.
It's like, yet again, I have picked correctly.
Well done, me.
Well done, me. Flap, flap of the big grey wings. do you have something slightly less morbid as a...
Yeah, this idea of the right people. So this is when Daphne takes him out to look at the cave and she's talking about the importance of everything.
Mm.
And she, we touched on this earlier. She says, I want the right people to see this. And his response is, the right people are seeing it.
Yes.
And it's the validation he takes from the cave. He says, send them here, but I know what this place means. My ancestors wanted to tell us that they were here. That's what it means. And he takes what he needs to take from the cave, even as there's this extra thing of, I want the Royal Society to see it. That's what I mean by the right people. It's this, Mal takes this internal validation of what it means as a member of the nation from the cave, whereas Daphne wants there to be some external validation of it.
Mm.
And Mal teaches her to maybe think differently about that.
Yeah.
And so then she does the same thing when talking to her father, because he has the attitude that she has. So she takes him to the cave and he says, all this belongs in a museum. And she says, yes, I know. That's why it's in one.
Yeah.
So just because this doesn't look like art galleries does not mean this is not a museum in its own right. And it should be here where people can come and see it.
Yeah.
Not yeeted off to the fucking British Museum.
Yes.
Not that the British Museum has got any artifacts it shouldn't have. And this goes on, this idea of the right people and his sort of stubborn colonialist-y Englishness about it, over the picture of spectacles, and he's trying to push her to prove her scientific hypothesis. Mm. He's doubtful at every turn. And this is partly just me finding it. She's to have a rantette, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I will.
She's pointing at the picture of the spectacles and saying, This I feel like this proves that they must have had them. Mm-hmm. Is, well, it could be a mask or scales or have some mysterious religious significance. Mysterious religious significance is my bugbear. I talked about this on the Patreon. I did a rabbit hole about the history of board games, and I had a little rant there. You would look at these ancient board games we found, they're like 5,000 years old, the Royal Game of Ur and Seneca and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And the people writing about them now and the speculation about how they were played and there's always this line somewhere of, and it's possible that this was a divination tool for people and they used it to predict fate. And it's like, are you saying that's possible because you think based on the structure of the board game there's evidence? Or are you saying that's possible because you're going, haha, people must have also had a mystical belief about it. They couldn't have just had this thing and played.
Yes. I often see archaeologists make fun of their own profession by saying, oh, it's a ritual object.
Yep. Ritual object just means we don't know what it is. The fuck this
ritual
is.
Object.
Yep. Yes.
Probably has some ritual significance. That'll be what it is.
Ritualistic significance of complaining about anus is bad copper.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, yeah, there's just a little bugbear there, and I think Pratchett does it very well and challenges it very well.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to look into, like, the issues with kind of depicting colonialism like this.
Yeah.
Trying to read it as critically as I could.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of the bits are in this very short section, I would say, which is the idea that, and I know it's meant to be skimmed over, but the idea that the British, they're fine, they just want you to wear trousers and worship their god. what I will say is that I quite like the idea that all it would take is 130 of the royalty to die and we could set the empire off on a less problematic... I felt silly going past it without noting it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, should we go on to the bigger stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure if this is the bigger stuff as much, really, just as taking it back to some of our more old school talking point things. I just really like some of the writing devices in this one, which is a big focus on colour, I think.
Yeah,
that's what kept jumping out at me anyway. Grey being the obvious one from the start, grey being the colour of death here. And it's very much grey, not black, not whatever. It's the desaturation of everything. And when you're in somewhere which is as bright and as saturated as the nation clearly is, as that part of the world is, that is the huge contrast. But then I started kind of trying to pay attention to whenever death was in the air or something like that. And you get moments like the sun was too bright to look at, was already boiling all of the colour out of the landscape. This is the morning of the duel.
Yes.
And then obviously you get all of the moments with Lokaha and the grey wings and and Daphne yet again reiterating the no colours of the underworld and the silver fish and no colours and no birds and just the opposite of the nation, I think is very interesting.
Yes.
You also get I would say the red and the black and the white for war is and bad things is like this recurring theme. And I always like I like splashes of red in, we've talked about red at great length for Monstrous Regiment, but I like splashes of red in writing as well as in paintings. Generally speaking, if you've got a lot of the same color or the same kind of palette, then a splash of red in it makes it kind of come together and makes it a little, just that little extra something. Yep. I believe it's the artistic term. No, I didn't Absolutely. Go to art college, can you tell?
As the French would say, I do not know.
A little something.
Son of something.
But yeah, so you get right at the beginning, obviously, you get all the red disinfectant. We talked about this, and it said like the red disinfectant part, like splashing at the feet. You get the red line of the horizon for Mao, and this is this sunrise, red skirt morning. And this time it's a volcano. Red skirt warning.
Volcanist warning,
yeah. Way too late for a warning at that point. You also get the red crabs, and every time they're described, they are the little red crabs, and you always get that.
Yeah,
you get the splash of colour every time, and you get to see it.
And you have the contrast. You have the little red crabs and the little blue hermit crabs.
Yes, yeah, you get the red blue. Yeah, that's a good point. And when you also get quite a lot of the like internal stuff described in colours. So Mao has like a strange, chilling thought dancing across his mind, like a white thread against the terrible red background. And this is the bit where he's thinking like cocks. And then a little later, any thought in those little white thoughts that scribbled their way along the redness of the pain in his lungs. And again, just I love how you can get a mental image of what he's talking about, like an internal thought process, just by little splashes of colour. I just think it's really cleverly done.
Yeah. And it's not just red, it's scribbles of red. I think there's something about the tone, the shape of that word.
Yeah.
And the immediate image it evokes, and then how quickly you can turn that mental image into the feeling of the pain.
Yeah, definitely. It's just, it's very clever. It's almost synesthesia kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it's trying to evoke. You also get the obvious ones. You get the raiders turning up with torchlight making red suns in the mist. And as I talked about earlier, the black and red war canoes against this picturesque golden scene.
Yeah. They're like a really, this harsh clash in the middle of something that should be very calm and very beautiful.
Exactly. And then right at the end, after like I'd been focusing on greys and reds or whatever, you kind of get the blue for good things. Like you said, the blue hermit crab. And then right at the end, you have the old man crying after he's been telling the story. And why are you crying, sir? Ah, good one. I must answer, mustn't I? Because you liked my blue Jupiter. Because we keep going. Because there are stars and blue hermit crabs. And again, it's just every time you can reiterate the color you do, and it really just, I don't know, I feel like it helped, it's adding like washes of color onto the picture, and I think it really helps. I don't know, I should be able to describe this better, but I cannot. I just really, I've decided to start focusing more on colors in Pratchett books, and I like it a lot.
I support this endeavor.
Do you know what, that just randomly has come back to me. I remember seeing a breakdown of some Lana Del Rey lyrics, and how evocative she managed to make stuff just by saying things like the blue of the water, or the splash of red lipstick, or something like that, and just how it brings you into the moment just for the splash of color. And I think it's a really clever writing device, and I expect the proper word for it. Maybe I should have looked that up before I started talking, but I didn't. Okay,
let's not do that. Don't do that, Francine. I love it. I love it the way you described it. I don't need a proper word for it.
Thank you. just as well, really. But yeah, I think I think probably. That's all the blue. There is quite a lot of different blues. You got the silver thread and the different things like that. But yeah. I think blue and red and grey are the three I wanted to talk about. Do you have something slightly more structured and less just splashing metaphorical paint onto a metaphorical canvas?
I can't promise I won't splash any metaphorical paint. But speaking of Pratchett being a really good fucking writer.
Oh, always a segue we can rely on.
Yeah. Speaking of Pratchett being a genius and... just the amount of shit he's set up that he pays off in these last few chapters. And we've done this before. We've talked about this before, but usually it's in a very different context. Normally when we're talking about like the clever setup and payoff, we're talking about things like the watch books. We're talking about mysteries and red herrings. And this is just establishing things and coming back and paying them off in a really clever way. It's just great writing. we have this running theme of knowledge becoming legend. When Daphne realizes late in the section that Saturn's rings and Jupiter's moons became these songs that we sing to children about the brothers of air being Jupiter's moons, about the paper vine woman and these vines tied around Saturn.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And Daphne says that's how the knowledge gets passed down, except you didn't know it was knowledge. And we get hints of it earlier in the section. We get Daphne starting to understand the song of the four brothers, and she's singing it over the beer. And the explanation of the need for the beer song, which we've had hints at throughout, as she does test it with Barbara Blacksheep. Yeah. Spit neutralizes the paralyzing chemical, and you have to give it a certain amount of time, and singing a song is how you mark that time.
And it's a fun, it was a little subversion, that one, wasn't it? Because when she started experimenting, the one thing she dismissed was spitting in it.
Which I'm sure that would be for luck. And the thing is, there are two ways to interpret these moments, and I don't think they're exclusive of each other. I think you can see both things in it. One is that this is somewhat racist and colonialist writing, which, you know, why should you need this white girl to come to the island to explain to you things that should be your history, and how that's challenging to read. But the other thing, and I'm not saying that's not entirely there and that it's not maybe a problematic element of the book, but I think the other thing, and the thing that Pratchett's intention, is this thing that's thematically set up in the previous section. It's what I talked about. You need there to be fresh eyes. It doesn't have to be a shipwrecked white girl, but there needs to be someone with fresh eyes and new ideas to get out of this rut of tradition. Much as in Pyramids, it's Tepic who's had this experience elsewhere and has brought it back, and that helps push the jelly baby elsewhere.
It's so funny to dip back into, especially early Discworld, when you try to talk about this such serious book. Like, back into a jelly baby.
Yeah. I'm not even sure I've got the right name, or if jelly baby was the place next to it, but I think it was jelly baby. Anyway, yeah, so it's this idea of Daphne being the fresh eyes needed to break us out of this rut of tradition and remind us that the tradition is more than just tradition, it's knowledge. And you have, of course, the story of the two brothers that fought that helps tie things together. He lived for many lifetimes and saw many things, but one day he found a place that was best of all because it was the island of his childhood, and he stepped on the shore and died happily because he was home again.
Yes.
And this idea of coming all the way around again. So you brought up in the first episode, you like this once upon a time idea, and the once upon a time for this at the beginning of the book, the creation myth is in the time when things were otherwise and the moon was different.
Yes.
And here we learn that things were otherwise and the moon was different because of these ice sheets melting.
And the stars were different.
And the stars were different. And we have this fission dating that helps us date the star maps. And the idea of the last wave, this point of contention between Mao and Ataba when they were going through the cave in the last section, that wave, again, coming from the ice sheets melting, that was the wave that came. Again, it was there in history, if not in knowledge. And this beautiful line, the people of the nation had sailed beyond the seas they knew under unfamiliar stars.
Yes. Yes. It's I also just the idea of the wave passing down in oral tradition as well. It wouldn't be us if we didn't then acknowledge the round world, cool, maybe the fucking the flood in Noah's Ark story, and all these other like myths and legends from ancient cultures and other cultures came from a real thing. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, maybe it was, you know, the Bronze Age collapse was maybe some of this together. Yeah.
Not just that, but First Nations and Aboriginal people having such an incredibly long tradition of oral storytelling and oral history that they are some of the best resources we have for knowing what the world was like 10,000 years ago.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because these stories have been so continually passed down, which I think I talked about a little bit in The Last Continent.
Yes, you definitely did. You might have talked about it more at length in One of the Rabbit Holes as well. But yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
That's so cool. Like, what was it, tens of thousands of years, literally, that you could track like back something that they'd...
That's you could, part of the storytelling tradition, part of the combined oral history.
And you could track it because the eclipse had happened. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah. And just some other like really great things where they're set up and they're paid off. The false teeth and the glass eyes were set up earlier in the book. And then when Daphne realizes what the boy has found, she's delighted because they might help Mrs. Gurgle, although they don't in the end. Tony forgot to mention grandmother chewing meat for Mrs. Gurgle. Great dynamic established there.
Also Mrs. Gurgle like grinning and the sun shining off her teeth like Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah, great.
Pratchett just clearly got a thing about big bling teeth in scary old people. Like, I'll tell you what this very cool old character needs. Incredibly expensive and practical teeth.
And Daphne summing up why they're so important. They were made by someone who did not just watch the skies and sail to new lands. He thought about small things that made life better for people.
Yes.
And how this is a sign of civilization, of historical civilization, of there was more than, you know, we were sat around fires as cavemen. You were improving things. You weren't just traveling and finding things. You were improving things. You were thinking about things.
Yeah, it's like the next step along from, you know, the first idea of civilization we glom onto is when somebody has a set broken leg.
Yes.
Like, this was a society.
Yeah. That they were cared for and that they were able to take the time to heal. They weren't left to die.
But yeah, I connected to that kind of the bit with the world upside down, the globe, like you were saying before, and the upside down maps. And then when the old man is showing the boy and the girl Blue Jupiter.
Yeah.
And he goes, and it was a shock, wasn't it? A moment of uncertainty. The world turned upside down. Just a bit creepy as well. Yeah. It's like, oop, look, little bit back.
I'd be remiss if not mentioning as well that The World Turned Upside Down is the name of an English folk song.
Is it?
And it's referenced in Monstrous Regiment.
Oh, cool. Oh, did I miss?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's referenced in and Polly knew all the songs.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah.
The World Turned Upside Down and Sweet Polly Oliver.
Oh, that's right. And Sweet Polly Oliver was the one we looked into. Yeah. Okay.
And The World Turned Upside Down is a song around the Revolutionary War era, which is why there's a song in Hamilton called The World Turned Upside Down, although it's nothing like the original folk song.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Cool. One kind of almost, payoff, I'd say, as well. I really liked, we talked about Mao and Daphne were talking about Newton and standing on the shoulders of giants and things.
Yeah.
And then when Daphne is talking about Mao making discoveries, she goes, I didn't discover this, actually Mao did. I looked over his shoulder and he had to walk past 100,000 ancestors. And I just thought that was like a little, like a rhyming callback almost rather than an exact one, because he got the shoulders and the hundred thousands of people. And I just thought that was... It was there.
Yeah, that was really good.
It made me think of the callback to Newton.
There were some other little payoff things as well. The cannons, I already jokingly said, they were Chekhov's cannons. Mm. They were introduced, they got used. Can't have a cannon and not do something with them. The raiders as well, the way they're slowly built up as a threat throughout the whole book, but every time they come up as a threat, a man might start worrying. There's something that changes the subject. It's more people coming to the island, or it's the cave, or it's... And then we get this echo. The raiders came just before dawn. After we've had these tests, these that have lulled us into, like, as a reader, into a false sense of security, almost as the island has, the practicing for if the raiders come. And in the moment where they finally do come, we get a callback to Mal's silver threads. He'd always had that trick with the silver thread that pulled him towards the future he pictured, but this time it was the future that had been tugging at him, pulling him to this place at this time. And then the way the idea of Daphne being royalty and royalty in general being involved and paid off early in this section when Foxlip and Palgrave are there, one of them calls her princess. Yeah. And she thought it was just like the mutineers. They called her baby names all the time. Yeah, she hated it. It made her flesh crawl. It was probably meant to. And of course, she is quite literally a princess. Yeah. She just doesn't know. And you have Cox saying, I'm a king. You've got to be nice to me. You should call me your majesty. When the Cutty Wren finally arrives, we get this callback to the ancestors when she realizes what's going on, that her father's king. In her mind's eye, ancestors toppled like dominoes.
Oh, yes.
138 of them.
Yes.
In the way that echoes the grandfather's falling in the cave.
And then you get the funny moment of, did my grandmother kill them all?
Which is fair. Like, if I was her, I'd wonder about it. We have this scientific hypothesis idea with Daphne and her father and talking about how you find proof. And we had this early thing of Nawi with the shark that I brought up in the first episode, testing things three times to make sure they work, which is this intersection of science and fiction, science and fantasy.
Rule of three.
The rule of three, because three is a pattern. And so it becomes a rule in stories, but it also becomes a rule in scientific testing.
Mm-hmm.
This early form of hypothesis and testing and proving. And of course, speaking of the rule of three, the axe comes back.
Yes.
And it's the third pull that pulls the axe out of the tree. It didn't obey the storybook rules before and come out when Mal dramatically pulled it, and it should have done.
Because it wasn't time yet.
Had to wait till it was needed.
Yes.
And Pilu, great Pilu moment. Again, the Pilu's description of the axe coming out of the water later on. It blocked the light of the sun. It made the stars come out. It caused thunderstorms and strange sunsets around the world.
That's what I heard.
Absolutely.
That's what I saw. I'm sorry, I remember 5 minutes ago. Thank you, Pilu.
And so then we get to something we've touched on, the perfect world and the parallel worlds. You have Mal turning down Logar's offer. And then, like Logar explains, everything that can happen must happen, and everything that can happen must have a world to happen in. And he pays off Mal's refrain with a new one. There's no such thing as does not happen, but there is always happen somewhere else.
Yeah.
And the way the book doesn't just, it's not just paying off a specific moment, is paying off so much of what Terry Pratchett's right. It turns the trousers of time from something that's occasionally quite silly to this blossoming beautiful thing. And as Mal learns this, he, it's almost like the world opens up for him. He knows all of these happens somewhere, places exist.
Yeah. And he's allowed to think to himself, no regrets. Like the boy, because the boy who is crying is happy somewhere.
Yeah.
Daphne stays somewhere.
We have this final payoff. I tricked you. I said I was going to talk about setup and payoff. I'm going to bring us back around to the theme of belief.
Sorry, that wasn't very convincing. There we go.
Thank you. This isn't...
Sorry.
Francine, gasp!
The fun thing is, if I do bleep that, it starts with a hard cuh.
The final payoff. In this final moment, the old man talking to these two children. And they talk about belief. And there's this quote from Mal that has been passed down. The old man remembers, I cursed Emo because he gave the birds and animals a way to sense great waves and didn't give it to smart beings like us. But I realised that he did. He made us smart, and it was up to us to be good at it. And the children ask the man what he believes. And he says, everything I know makes me believe Emo is in the order which is inherent, amazingly, in all things. And the way the universe opens up to our questioning. And this conversation takes place before this girl goes to guard the island for the night, holding a spear, and her father will be watching because fathers watch. And the solution, the win, the completion of this idea of what it means to grieve and to believe or not believe in gods is not, we got clever so we didn't need gods anymore. It's I found gods in the absolute wonder of the things we learned and discovers. And we did not have to lose what made us the nation to become this.
Can I double Dutch twist it back for one second? Which is right at the beginning. And then when we talk about Pratchett's conceiving of the idea of the book, he said the first thing that popped into his head was Mal standing on a beach with the spear looking out into the ocean. So... like the end of this really is like the
full circle. Like,
yeah.
Like he's gone around the world and come back again to the island.
Yeah. Like this really is the very, 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 very beginning. More so the real beginning than the pink disinfectant, I'd say.
Matt Pratchett. Mm. Good writer.
Mm. I'm going fishing.
Mm. And of course there were two dolphins, but no one noticed because they were crying too much to see them.
Obviously, there were two dolphins.
Obviously, there were two dolphins.
Of course, there were two dolphins. Oh, mate, that... Oh, fuck.
Knowing that Daphne went back to the island at the end.
Yeah. My face is going shiny, and I don't know... I'm pretending there's nothing wrong.
Francine, have you got an obscure reference finial for me?
I mean, not really. Kind of, yeah. I didn't know that maroon could... because they talked about seeing a maroon fired. I was like, what?
Yes.
I didn't know maroon could refer to a rocket that you fire. To get attention.
If you are marooned,
yeah. But there isn't any solid, apparently, connection from the etymology there. It's likely, but there's also theories that it's because the rockets are often red. While I was trying to work out what I wanted as my orf, which is swearing into a barrel full of water, and whether that was a real thing on ships. If it is, I wasn't able to find it in time. One of these seafaring superstitions I came across was that if a man's head is ringed in Elmo's fire, he'll be dead within the day. And obviously, right at the beginning, we had Captain Roberts reused in Elmo's fire, and he was dead within the verse, I believe. So, I would also like to look further into the sub-millimeter array radio telescopes, which do appear to be built on an island chain in Hawaii. And I assume there's some very good geographical reasons for this, but that occurred to me right at the end of the research process. And I thought, do you know what? I'm not going to learn about telescopes right now.
Yeah, that's probably stand by for that the best decision, Bronson.
But I'm going to look to it anyway, because it's really interesting. I didn't know anything about it. Even if the old man prefers his stand-up-y one.
And Blue Jupiter. Quickly, before I outro, I should probably mention, because I forgot to say in that section, I also am greatly delighted by how much this book becomes of its time by the list of modern scientists it uses coming to the island to say this is modern day now. Because I don't think Terry Pratchett, even 5 years later, would have called Dawkins that nice Richard Dawkins.
Well, Mike, he's probably perfectly pleasant in person.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's up to these days, do you?
Transphobia.
Oh.
And being weird about bees.
What?
Or he was weird about honey or something. No, he was weird about honey.
Why? What?
A couple of years ago. I don't fucking know. Anyway, Patrick Moore was there, who Pratchett was friends with and used to go to observatory parties
at.
Cool.
Yes, that's a whole thing. That's a really nice chapter in Rob Wilkins's book.
Yes.
All right. But so this is literally because I copy-pasted it into my notes and I couldn't find anywhere to shoehorn it in. Love this line. There's a ship coming towards them and it's the largest one he had seen with so many sails it looked like a storm heading for them. How cool is that?
Yes. Sorry, this is just us dragging it out because we don't want to stop talking about Nation. It's such a good book.
True.
I think for now, this is everything we're going to say about the book Nation.
It's 10 o'clock now. Yeah.
Because it is 10 o'clock and I will.
We will turn into pumpkins.
Nothing to do with the time, it happens. So we are potentially going to have a couple of weeks off. We're back in May. We're back on the 6th of May with part one of I Shall Wear Midnight. Very excited for that. In the meantime, until then, dear listener, you can join our Discord, link down below. You can follow us on Instagram at The Tree Show Make You Fret. You can follow us on Twitter and Blue Sky at Make You Fret Pod. On Facebook at The Tree Show Make You Fret. Join our subreddit, r/TTSMYF. Email us your thoughts, queries, castle snacks, famous scientists, and tree climbing octopods, thetreeshowmakeyoufretpod@gmail.com. And if you want to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/thetreeshowmakeyoufret, where you can exchange your hard-earned pennies for all sorts of bonus nonsense. And until next month, dear listener, the old man smiled and believed.
For maybe the first time, I'm going to deliberately put something after the outro music instead of just nicking.
Just talking bollocks.
Yeah, exactly. Or nicking a clip from further on, which is, I love the little scientific explanations at the end of this. At the end of Nation, the author's note.
Oh, yeah.
I enjoyed the 5 exclamation marks.
Yes.
Dropped into there. Nothing could be further from the truth that this is a book set in the Pacific Ocean. The drowning bullets was something he looked into and was talking about in one of the interviews I linked in the first episode. The idea is I'm pretty sure that this would happen, but I'm going to have to ask some scientists about this very practically. Blue Jupiter, I'd never heard of until this. But I love the fact that it's also, you know, Pratchett's favourite thing, and he is showing it to us in the same way that the old man in his story is showing the kids, just by showing us through the story. I love that. Like, and look at this. look at how good this is. But also don't look at the sun through a telescope, kids.
Yes.
That's his warning, and it should also be ours. At the end of every episode, really. I can't believe we've been this irresponsible.
Never windsurf on a crocodile.
Never look at the sun through a telescope.
Put jam on a magnet. Never put your granny in a bag. Cor, blimey.